I'm Sonia Morton Firth, and today you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. My guest today is Roland Chesters. Roland was diagnosed with HIV and AIDS in 2006 and given only 2 weeks to live. He then contracted PML, which is a brain disease that essentially left Roland paralyzed. Roland overcame his chronic illness and went on to campaign for disability rights in the workplace. Roland has written a best-selling book, Ripples from the Edge, and he's also been amongst the finalists in the 2019 Diversity Awards as a role model for disability. Roland, I'm truly honoured to have you as a guest on my show today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Roland, tell me, how did it feel when you were first diagnosed with HIV and AIDS and given 2 weeks to live?
Well, it was the culmination of a fairly long process. I'd been feeling increasingly unwell over a period of 2 years. During that period of time, I gradually was losing the use of my arms, the use of my legs, the ability to speak, memory. I was getting very confused. I was working as a civil servant in Westminster, and on my regular commute home from Westminster to Surrey, I would get on a train and not know where I was. I'd phone my partner and say, I don't know where I am. And he'd say, get off the train, tell me what it says on the platform, and I'll come and find you. I had seen many different specialists, many different consultants, anybody ending in ologist, neurologist, cardiologist, oncologist, you name it, I've been to see them. Lots of different tests, no concrete diagnosis. I started getting these blinding pains in my head, fleeting blinding pains. My partner was so concerned, he paid for me to go and see a private neurologist in Harley Street. More tests.
Yes.
Neurologist said what you've got is called pickaxe syndrome, as if somebody has stuck a pickaxe in your head.
Syndrome, yeah. Okay.
There's nothing
doesn't sound good.
It doesn't. And he said, there's nothing we can do about it. You just have to learn to live with it. And here's some antidepressants.
Oh, lovely.
So my partner...
That's fantastic.
Well, no help at all. Mm. My partner thought that perhaps going away for a weekend would help. Mm. So we decided to go off to Paris for a weekend. I'm half French. I've lived in Paris. I know it well. But whilst we were there, I collapsed in the underground. And Richard, my partner, had to carry me home, literally, physically.
Is he a big man?
He's a big man. I don't remember any of that, but he does. And because of that, he started coming with me to see the various consultants. Mm. And we ended up going together to see a chest consultant in our local hospital at Kingston. They thought they found something on my lungs. Turned out to be chicken pox scars, so nothing serious. But this particular consultant, recognising that we were a same-sex couple, asked if I'd ever had a HIV test, and I hadn't. I was in my early 20s when icebergs and tombstones drifted across our television screens and came through every letterbox in the land. So I thought I was informed. At that point, Rich and I had been together for 10 years, a monogamous relationship. I'd had one previous relationship before that. I never thought there was
a need.
So
no reason for you to get tested.
But I said to this consultant, test me for anything, because I actually thought I was going mad. I thought that people thought that I was putting it on.
Yeah,
that
I was, at this point, I guess you've exhausted everything. Yeah. Just go for everything.
So test me. So I had the test done on Thursday, the 31st of August, 2006. It's dates like those that you never forget.
You'll never forget.
Never. The following day, we were going to go on holiday for 2 weeks on a Saturday. So I told the consultant, I'll pick up the results when I come back. It's fine. There's no rush. The following day, Friday the 1st of September, I staggered into work to put on my out of office. Richard was at home packing the suitcases. When I got home later that afternoon, there were no cases packed. And I said to Richard, why? What's happening? Are we not going away? And Richard took me in his arms and he started to cry. And he's physically big, but he's emotionally strong as well. In the 10 years we've been together at that point, I'd never seen him cry before. So I knew something serious was wrong. The consultant had phoned home to get my office number to say that if I went away for 2 weeks, I would come home in a cardboard box. The consultant wanted to tell me, but Richard said to him, no. I'll tell him when he comes back. And this is against all.
Yes, because normally they have to tell, yeah.
So it was Richard who gave me that diagnosis. If the roles were reversed, I'm not sure I'd have been strong enough to be able to do that. But this is the man that I love, the man who loves me, that tells me.
I can't even imagine what that must have felt. I mean, what was going through your mind? You've got a couple of weeks to live and the person that you love is telling you this.
To be honest, my first reaction, thinking back, was one of relief. This is real. It's genuine. I haven't made it up. There is something wrong with me that people now have to believe that there I am ill. I'm not going mad. There is truth in this. I can relax a bit, was my first reaction. And I was so ill, I went to sleep.
So that you're basically, you've been told the news and you go to sleep. There wasn't, and it was a relief.
It was. Obviously, when I woke up, we spent some of that weekend planning my funeral. In hindsight, how wonderful is that? How many people get to plan their own? We should do.
Yes, I guess. It's.
But to be given that opportunity.
And had you planned the next sort of few weeks of things that you'd wanted to do? Because at this point you'd contracted AIDS.
Yeah.
And how did that manifest itself? I believe you had something that I can't pronounce, PML,
for short. Progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. It's actually taken me 12 years to be able to say that. I had to put the right teeth in. It is. PML is much better. It's a brain disease. In my case, affected the cells at the base of the brain, which are the ones that govern your motoring skills, hence my paralysis. Richard, fortunately, had just been made redundant, so he was at home and he became my carer. He had to do everything for me. I was incapable of showering, cleaning myself or anything like that. The decision was made by medical staff not to hospitalise me because my immune system had been so compromised. If I went into the hospital, I definitely wouldn't come out alive. So I was treated at home. But it meant that Richard had to sanitise everything in the house. Every piece of food that came in, fruit and veg and what have you, had to be washed in boiled water. So he went out and bought a big pot, it home with a ribbon wrapped around it.
And this was in case you contracted more illnesses and more diseases.
Because I don't know how much you know about HIV and AIDS, so forgive me if I'm telling you the information that you already know.
I was brought up in the 80s, so I remember it being all over the headlines, headline news.
Yeah.
And obviously the Freddie Mercury film Bohemian Rhapsody has just made it again come out. Yeah. But absolutely, there's, I think, a lot of the generations these days probably don't know a lot about it. But sorry,
I was going to say that HIV is a virus that attacks your immune system, and when it has destroyed your immune system to a certain extent, that allows other opportunistic infections to come into your body. That's when you have AIDS. So I was diagnosed as being HIV positive. I was diagnosed as having an AIDS-defining illness, which was PML.
And in those 2 weeks, I read a little bit of your book, and you mentioned, but we'll come back to the book, that at one point you were at such a low point you'd contemplated suicide and actually walked to the end of your path.
That was later on.
Well, that was later
that
on.
That was later on. I couldn't walk. I wouldn't have been able to get out of the front door, never mind down to the riverbank. That particular episode that you're referring to was about 2 years later.
Okay, so what had happened? How did you were given 2 weeks to live, yet obviously you're sitting here today.
I'm not a ghost. Really, you're not a ghost.
How did you get through that?
With wonderful support from Richard. I can't stress enough how lucky I am. Mm. I've worked with lots of people whose relationships have disintegrated because of this kind of thing. Richard has stuck with me throughout all of this. I'm hugely grateful to him. Great medical support. Richard and my HIV district nurse essentially bullied me into going back to work. They're saying, we're not allowing you to become an invalid staying at home. You have to go back to work. And that's part of the normalisation process.
Yes, I can imagine.
And although it was really difficult, hugely difficult. I'm very grateful and have been very lucky in many ways. And I guess it's part of mindset as well, that HIV doesn't define me. I am somebody living with HIV. Somebody once described it as being HIV is a lodger in my house. But I can shut the door on them.
What is it, how does it feel to live with the knowledge that any potential time you can contract AIDS again?
It's not actually the case. So nowadays, I'm on so much medication that the HIV virus is suppressed within my system. So I'm now what is called undetectable. The instruments that are used to measure how much virus is in my bloodstream, even though they are so refined, can't detect the virus because there's so little of it, because it's been contained by the medication, that I'm undetectable. They can't detect the virus, which means that I'm not going to become ill. If I continue to take the medication regularly, as I have to, I will not allow my immune system to become so compromised that another AIDS-defining opportunistic illness can get into my system. It also means that people who are what is now called undetectable are not infectious, because the virus is so weak, it cannot be transmitted from one person to another person. So there's a new slogan, U equals U. Undetectable equals untransmittable.
Wow, I didn't know, coming from those days back in the 80s and early 90s, and, you know, you were taught about, if you come into any sort of contact, the blood passes blood or anything like that, then you were potentially at risk. You were given 2 weeks to live. Do you know now where you are? Is there... without trying to sound callous, have you got a life expectancy other than anybody else?
For me personally, because I was diagnosed late. Late diagnosis means somebody whose immune system is so compromised that they have got an opportunistic infection, they are classified as having AIDS. For people who are diagnosed late, the virus can have had an impact on various bits of their body. So for me, because I had AIDS, because I had encephalopathy, there are various functions that are starting to go wrong. I was told, so going back to 2 weeks diagnosis that weekend, we went into the sexual health clinic on the Monday morning with Richard, and they said to me, yeah, you are extremely unwell. We're going to start you on treatment. If you adhere to the treatment, we will hopefully save your life, but your life expectancy will have been reduced because your body has been compromised. And at that time, I was told that potentially 15, 16, 17 years. That was 13 years ago.
Okay, that would make me quite worried right now then. Have you had further diagnosis since, or anything to say?
I'm great.
Yeah, I mean, you look fit and healthy, and
could do
wonderful
with
losing energy.
Some weight, but I feel fine. I could come out of here and get run over by a 92 bus.
Absolutely, absolutely, you could.
But the greatest gift from what has happened to me is that realization that life is finite.
Talking about the greatest gift. How do you see this as maybe an awakening or a benefit?
Absolutely, totally. I, even in my darkest of days now, I am hugely grateful for what this diagnosis has brought to me, what it has given to me. Before my diagnosis, in my mid-40s, as I was becoming unwell, I was going through the male menopause. What's it all about? Why am I here? Where's it going? It happens. Yeah. And then I had the diagnosis. And yes, a period of huge darkness and a period of uncertainty and confusion and fear and anger and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, which is all natural.
Yeah. But then coming out of that, I have found a voice. I found a passion. I found a mission. I have a legacy that I can leave. I've helped many people, I hope, to find their voice. And if I were to walk out the road, out into road now and get run over by a bus, I'd be able to say, fine, I achieved something. And for me, that's the most important bit.
Completely. How would you change, or would you change, in terms of, you know, having HIV, how people see HIV today? Are you treated in any different way?
Absolutely. The stigma that surrounds still HIV is still very much there.
Because we don't hear about it in the news anymore. We were bombarded in the 80s and the 90s, and it was obviously when it was all fresh and it was just coming out. Mm. But, you know, you rarely turn on the TV or open a newspaper and hear of somebody that's either died of AIDS or HIV statistics or anything like that. Is it even taught in schools?
No, it hasn't been taught in schools because many schools fear how they're going to teach it. I'm part of a group of people, volunteers, that work for Towns Against Trust, which is the main HIV charity in the UK, and we're called Positive Voices. Mm. And we go out and speak to schools or to any other organisation, employers, whatever, that want to listen to us talking about our stories of being diagnosed with HIV. Particularly when we go to schools, it's always, you have to be very careful. We're only allowed to talk to children of a certain age upwards, which is, you know, fine. But there was one particular school that we went to twice. We went once and we went back a couple of weeks later. Yeah. When we went back the second time, the same teacher was organising it, and she shared with us that after we'd spoken the first time to the group of children, children had gone home, said that they'd had somebody talking to them about HIV, and a substantial number of parents had complained to the school that their children had been exposed to this kind of information.
Really? That's absolutely astounding, and that's actually horrible that you have parents that are not allowed or trying to say that their children shouldn't be exposed to something that's valuable information.
I don't have any children.
But I'd want them to be educated.
Well, these are children that are bubble wrapped. So not exposed to anything that's horrible or...
But ignorance equals discrimination.
Don't die of ignorance was the original epitaph that went under the HIV and AIDS tombstones and icebergs. Don't die of ignorance. And yet, ignorance is about HIV and AIDS is still huge here in the UK. I carried out a survey for World AIDS Day last year. It's 1st of December every year. December 2018 was the 30th World AIDS anniversary. So I commissioned a survey of 2,000 people across the UK, telephone survey. Different range of demographics, all ages, genders, where they lived and all that kind of stuff. Asked a series of questions about what they knew about HIV and AIDS and how they felt about it. One of the questions was, if you had a friend who told you that they were HIV positive, how would you react? Five different answers from it's absolutely fine to I would actually end that friendship. 21% of the respondents said they would end that friendship. One in five.
What? Would end their relationship if they knew their friend or someone they knew had HIV. That's absolutely, again, it's down to ignorance.
It is, purely. I don't blame those people. HIV and AIDS is one of those things where you're only going to find out information if it's directly relevant to you. You're not in an idle moment going to sort of do an internet search on HIV and AIDS. So people can have access to the information if they want it. But again, it goes back to the fact that, I suppose, in tombstones, mid-1980s, in 2010, Norman Fowler, now Lord Norman Fowler, who was the health secretary at the time, who pushed the campaign out, had a House of Lords Select Committee inquiry into having the government create a new campaign of information, not a campaign of fear, its original was, but a campaign of information. House of Lords Select Inquiry spoke to many people, put some recommendations to the government, including that there should be a new campaign of information, and of course it never happened.
Never happened.
Never happened.
Why do you think it never happened?
Other priorities, not seen as something particularly essential or important. Of course, it costs money to do that kind of thing. So it's now down to the charities that support people with HIV and AIDS to try and get that information out.
Yes, it's still prevalent today.
What?
Well, HIV, it's
the numbers of newly diagnosed people are decreasing.
Yes.
Which is great. Here in the UK. Mm. It's not so in other parts of the world, but just talking about the UK here. So we've seen the introduction of something that's called PrEP, pre-exposure prophylactic, which is essentially a small element of the medication that I take that somebody who is not HIV positive can take to protect their immune system if they are at risk of being exposed to the HIV virus.
Okay.
But the funny thing is that at the time this was proposed to the NHS here in the UK, Scotland and Wales, access to PrEP is now freely available, not in England. The NHS ummed and awed and said, actually, and it's that judgmental thing, I think, why should we pay that amount of money to protect people who are engaging in some kind of activity that we as a society deem to be unacceptable? HIV is surrounded by all these Victorian taboos.
Yeah, absolutely. Stigmas.
Well, it's death, it's homosexuality, and it's sex. Mm. And those are the big three Victorian taboos that we still don't talk about in polite society.
Without which we wouldn't have a society to carry on, really. It's astounding that we still think and live like that. Roland, in terms of yourself and any stigmas that you still receive, do you receive any of these? Are you still...
So, certainly in the early days, for example, when I went back to work, I was off work for 5 months. Sexual health records are kept separate to other medical records. Mm. My employers were only told that I had PML and nothing else. But I decided when I went back to work, I got hidden in enough shadows as a gay man. I wasn't going to do this anymore. So I told my immediate line manager, she went off to HR as she should do, and the message came back that I shouldn't tell anybody else because my employers could not be held responsible for how other people would react or respond to that information. So I was gagged, essentially.
And this was the civil service?
Yeah.
That's a government organisation that is telling you not to be honest with your other employees, and your employer supported that.
But I eventually fought back against it. And I got to a point where I was very open and out at work. One World AIDS Day, I decided to bring in speakers from Terence Higginstrutz to give a lunchtime talk about HIV. I put posters up around the office, publicising it, saying that I was organising it as a colleague living with HIV and AIDS. Posters were defaced, graffitied.
You're joking, what?
Some were slashed with a knife or scissors. Some were ripped off the walls and torn into bits and then trodden on. My line manager removed some before I had a chance to see them. And that shocked me. That visceral gut reaction to a poster.
And we're talking about...
10 years ago.
10 years ago, not 20, not 30 years ago.
And
there is clear discrimination still around.
And in the civil service, which is supposedly composed of fairly intelligent people, that shocked me. But that made me stronger. So now I don't experience any stigma because I have nothing to hide. It's all out there. You can say whatever you want to say. I'm big enough and old enough and strong enough to be able to say, actually, let me educate you about this, rather than you displaying, not you personally, but you displaying your ignorance. I'm here to educate and inform and help you to understand.
And the world needs more people like you.
And there are plenty like me. I'm not alone in this.
Roland, you went on then to write a book
of
13 narratives. And you mentioned, we mentioned earlier about your thoughts of suicide.
Yeah.
Talk me through that and a little bit more about the book.
About 2 years in after being diagnosed, I decided I needed to know more about HIV and AIDS. Knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. Terence Higginstrutz runs courses for newly diagnosed people. It's one evening a week for 6 weeks. So I applied to go on one of the courses. You have to get a letter of confirmation from your clinic that you are actually living with HIV, because apparently some people without HIV have tried to get onto these courses. Why, I don't know. So I contacted the clinic, they said, yes, fine. They sent me the letter. And I remember receiving it on a Friday in July. And the clinics are very careful about not exposing you to too much information about your condition. So in this letter it says we can confirm that Roland Chester is living with HIV and advanced HIV, which is essentially AIDS. And it was the first time I'd seen it in black and white, in writing, my name, HIV positive. And for me, I felt that was my death sentence. This is what is going to kill me. And because I wasn't particularly well informed at the time, in my mind, my death will be long, protracted, painful, degrading. And I didn't want that. I didn't want Richard to have to go through that either. So that Friday evening, Richard came home from work. I didn't tell him about the letter. We had dinner as normal. We went to bed. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was still awake. And for me, at that point, I'd lost all hope. The appeal of oblivion became overwhelming. So I got up, dressed myself quietly, let myself out of the house, closed the front door. We live very close to the river. I turned left at the garden gate to make my way down to the riverbank. And it was one of those summer mornings. It had rained during the night, so the world was fresh and beautiful and clean. I sat by the river. I took my shoes off, brand new pair of Timberland shoes. Why waste them? Somebody else could use them. And went to put my feet into the water. And as I did so, arms came round me. Richard had followed me out of the house. I didn't know. He just held me. I could feel his heart beating against me. And he just said, "I will miss you." We stayed there I don't know how long. And he eventually said, "Come, let's go home." We walked home, hand in hand, as the sun was coming up. And then on the Monday morning, you're going to work and people say, "How was your weekend?" You don't share. But that's something I'll never forget.
Well, now you're going on and I'm sure you've saved a lot of lives, and your book is out there, and I know you're nominated for an award. Tell me about the award.
It's super exciting. It's National Diversity Awards. So I've been shortlisted as a role model for disability. There are 10 different awards, 10 people shortlisted out of 28,000 nominations.
Wow.
I know. So, super excited.
Really exciting. And can we nominate for you?
It's too late. It's all closed now. The awards ceremony is on the 20th of September in Liverpool, so I'll let you know.
Oh, absolutely. Do definitely let
but
us
I've
know.
But I've looked at the other 9 people that are nominated in the same category as me, and they are awesome, truly fabulous, inspirational people. So, just the fact that I'm there amongst those 10 is more than enough for me.
Fantastic. Roland, where can people learn more about you and the work that you do through your company, Luminate?
There's my Luminate website, so that's luminate.uk.com. You can look me up on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, all the usual social media stuff.
And all that will be in the show notes as well.
Yeah, and the book is available through my website or from Amazon as well.
Roland, I always ask, this is my last question. If you were to write a message in a bottle that was going to be found for future generations, what would that message be?
Because you asked me, you told me that you'd ask me this question.
I did.
I've given
you
it some
absolutely
thought.
Can.
One of the issues that I now have as a result of my brain disease, I have very poor memory, so I have to write things down. So forgive me if I read it. But I've given it a lot of thought. My message would be, for somebody opening the bottle, in the end, we are all only a grain of sand on the biggest beach in the universe. But that doesn't mean that you should make every effort, seize every opportunity, shine in every way possible to make your grain of sand the brightest. So that it shines forever across the universe.
Roland, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.